bookstore and publishing firm. The sign notes that books are the source of knowledge and help to shape people's identity. The ideas contained in books cannot be erased by bombs and warplanes. They will live on. This library is my whole life, said Mansour. I was shocked when the Israeli occupation decided to bomb the building. It felt like I myself had been destroyed. The library benefits all members of society, he added. It is an independent library that has nothing to do with politics. I did not expect for a moment that it would be bombed in this way. This means that the Israeli regime wants to destroy our identity and culture in Gaza. It's shameful, he added. Mariam Riaz, a history student at Al-Aqsa University in Gaza, described the library as a constant companion. There is no student at our university who hasn't been in this library, she said. It was both beautiful and useful. I have so many memories from there. Khaled Omar, an engineering student at Al-Azhar University, immersed himself in literature thanks to the library. I would borrow a novel or a collection of poetry, he said, and I would absorb these books. When I saw thousands of books destroyed and lying on the ground, I felt that my own heart had been destroyed. The Israeli regime does not respect books and culture. That's why it has bombed a library. As well as running the library and bookstore, Mansour's firm published books by local authors. The firm worked with more than 150 writers, as well as publishing translations of European literature. Mansour has calculated that he lost at least $700,000 worth of books and equipment as a result of the bombing. Another bookstore owned by Shaban Aslim was destroyed during last month's offensive against Gaza. The Israeli regime has a history of attacking Palestinian arts and culture. In 2018, for example, the Zionist regime bombed the Said Mishal Cultural Center. That five-story building hosted Gaza's main theater, as well as other classes, poetry readings, and exhibitions. During last month's attack, the Zionist regime also bombed the Ghazi Shawa building hosting the Gaza offices of Open Screenplay. A Canadian firm, Open Screenplay, has developed technology to assist budding movie writers. While none of Open Screenplay's staff were harmed, the firm reported that at least four people were killed when the building was bombed. Another facility attacked by the Israeli regime was the recording studio Masharek. It was in that studio that the popular singer Mohammed Asif, best known for winning the TV contest Arab Idol, made his first recordings. The Basma Society for Culture and Arts, which offers drama programs for children and women, was damaged too. The bombing of Samir Mansour's project has caused a widespread revulsion. Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Al-Quds quickly demonstrated their support for Mansour by opening a bookstore named in his honor. The act of solidarity is poignant given that Sheikh Jarrah has become synonymous with ongoing efforts by the Zionist regime to force Palestinians out of their homes. Muhammad Al-Sharif from Gaza's Culture Ministry noted that Samir Mansour's library was one of 44 cultural institutions destroyed or damaged by the Israeli regime last month. More than $3 million worth of damage was inflicted on Gaza's cultural sector, the ministry has calculated. The Israeli regime believes that destroying our cultural institutions will make us forget our cause, Al-Sharif said, adding, "But that will not happen. We will keep on reading."
We the people.
Floyd tragedy a year on.
The murder of George Floyd made him a household name overnight. With Eric Chauvin kneeling on his neck and ignoring the bystanders, incremental shortage of breath led to an incredible tragedy that impacted the course of the black movement in America.
I think if we had just had him pass away or die and nothing happened as a result of it, it would have felt like it was not worth the pain and suffering. And don't get me wrong, I definitely wish I could have him back, but since we can't, this is nice to be able to see all of the people who are in support of us.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamadi. Floyd's tragic death, whose footage shocked the world, ended up being quite consequential. The former Minneapolis police officer was ultimately found guilty of all three charges. The sentence was essential to appease the black community with a piece of justice after decades of ongoing brutality against the African-American community.
That hopefully one day our world will change, and that there will be and still will be, continue to be, blind justice. I really want that to happen before I die.
A year ago, around this time, Minneapolis was on fire, entire buildings and in some cases blocks. Floyd was killed over an alleged misdemeanor offense. He died under the knee of a police officer, positing a case that brought the issue of racism to the forefront. Floyd's death was different in that it was undeniably brutal.
Hey, look at you, your body language explains it, you f***ing bum.
Bro, get the fuck off of
here. It's the whites. They love
you. Yeah, I already know that, bro. I trained with half of these bum ass dudes at the academy, bro. You know that's bogus right now, bro.
Most Americans could not ignore what the cell phone video showed and the message that Floyd was sending to the whole nation and beyond. Therefore, he kickstarted an unapologetic recalibration of how Americans think about race. We're now joined by Margaret Kimberly, the co-founder of Black Agenda Report from New York. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. Good to be back.
Ms. Kimberly, a year after the Floyd tragedy, has the American law enforcement learned anything about systematic racism among police forces?
No, they haven't learned anything because they are the ones who are systemically racist. They have not changed. They know that they work with the system, and the goal of the system is to keep black people in particular, under physical control. So no, they don't see things any differently, and I think that's an expectation we should not have. Our goal should be to make sure that the rest of us talk about systemic racism and the role that law enforcement plays, and making certain that they cannot behave as they have in the past.
Definitely some very interesting points there. Many thanks for your insight, Ms. Kimberly.
The American nation honored the life of George Floyd with memorial events and marches 1 year after his demise. The George Floyd family also visited the White House and met with President Joe Biden.
As Floyd's name was echoing across the country, other symbolic figures came to mind, such as 18-year-old Michael Brown Jr., who was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, 2014. Many lives have indeed been lost to violence and police brutality in America. Our next guest is Gerald Horn, a professor of American and African Studies at the University of Houston, Texas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Many thanks. Professor Horn, how do you think the brutal murder of George Floyd has influenced policing in America?
There has been a flood, a tidal wave of journalism and writing and stories on television about racism, police violence, etc. But as noted, I don't think that that has stemmed the tide with regard to police violence, as evidenced by the growing numbers of black people who are still being killed. If anything, as noted, it might have caused police officers to become more cautious to make sure that no one is filming them when they're killing suspects or killing black people.
Many thanks for your insight, Dr. Gerald Horn.
Floyd's case was a high-profile one with a rather pleasing resolution meant to calm the public and put an end to protests that could have otherwise raged on for years to come. Cases of police brutality against people of color do not often end like that.
As the former Minneapolis police officer was being removed from court in handcuffs, many were wondering whether justice has really been served. Is this an end, or is it just a turning point in the long journey of defending the people of color's rights in the United States?
That racial profiling should be ditched, should be eliminated, but I don't think that that's the lesson that has been learned. I think that a lesson that should be learned is that if you want to convict an officer for police brutality, you should make sure that the prosecution is able to contract with expert witnesses, as happened in the Derek Chauvin case. You should make sure that an expert selection of the jury takes place, as happened in the Derek Chauvin case.
George Floyd and what happened to him is now also symbolic of an age-old American struggle still far from results. Institutional systemic change is yet to materialize. Racism in the United States comprises negative attitudes and views on race or ethnicity, which could have deadly consequences in police encounters with minorities.
Put your hands out to the side! Hands out to the side, now!
Hill lay for more than 6 minutes without aid, a violation of police policy. He was later pronounced dead at the hospital.
To see him lying in the driveway, minute after minute after minute, with no attempt to render aid, and that is a stunning disregard for life, and in this case, black life.
Systemic racism is not simply a thing of the past, but is deeply embedded within the American society. Throughout the country's history, the hallmarks of the so-called American democracy have been largely reserved for white people.
They can't assume that they can let the police get away with this. There have been other cases of killings caught on video where the police nevertheless were either not charged or weren't indicted and therefore put on trial, or were found not guilty if they do go on trial. But I think they know there's a possibility that the police can be charged and may have to pay a price.
Floyd was a normal citizen who got tangled in an altercation with police. He resisted arrest due to shortage of breath and lost his life after saying the iconic "I can't breathe" sentence, which had already become a Black Lives Matter slogan. With injustice and police brutality raging on against minorities, Derek Chauvin's sentence led to a rare moment of accountability in the U.S. judicial system.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter, as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. Signed, juror foreperson, juror number 19. action, verdict count two. Leave the jury in the above entitled matter as count two. Third degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty.
The system tried to portray Chauvin as an isolated racist in the police department. But many activists believe that there is systematic racism within the justice system, and that is the main cause for victimization of other races. But what can come out of a combination of racism and a highly militarized police force?
The police that routinely patrol black communities, you would think that they were in Fallujah or in Kabul, Afghanistan. That is to say, they are heavily armed, even though the people they are confronting do not even have rocks or slingshots. So certainly we need to demilitarize the police. Defunding the police basically means that you do not need a man or woman with a gun to stop a driver to see if their license is operative, to stop a driver to see if the light on their back tail is operative.
Many other African Americans have been shot since Floyd's death, warning the nation that police brutality, gun violence, and racism are here to stay. Like many other states in America, violence in Minneapolis is commonplace.
Floyd's passing is a painful reminder of the price the African American community has paid in the country. He was an ordinary black man, but his demise enabled him to do something that most have not. Floyd transcended imposed barriers in the society and elevated important conversations in the United States. But what role did Floyd's death play in the Black Lives Matter movement, and what lies ahead for the movement in the immediate future?
The murder of George Floyd in May 25, 2020, electrified the Black Lives Matter movement. I think particularly heartening to this movement were the solidarity demonstrations overseas, not least in Western Europe, not least in Australia, not least in Africa itself. Indeed, you may know that the African Union, headquartered in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, was ready to launch a human rights investigation of the United States of America in the wake of the George Floyd killing.
Today, the black community is struggling to find its footing, be it through fire or through greed. As a result, Americans are reimagining the idea of safety and security. They want policies to change for the sake of blind justice. Chauvin's abuse of power has had far-reaching impacts on policing, not only in Minneapolis, but also around the country. More than anything else, Black Lives Matter activists are calling for police reform. On top of the agenda is banning chokeholds, eliminating no-knock warrants, and creating a national registry for police misconduct. What about defunding the police? Is that a viable solution?
Here in New York City, where I live, they claim to have cut the police budget, but they didn't at all. They just took certain jobs out of the police budget. But they didn't change policing. That has to be the demand to change policing, because if you just say take money away from the police, it can mean any number of things. They can call private police. So what the demand should be to change policing and to minimize its role in society, that has to be the demands, because if you only talk about money, it's easy for them to pretend that there has been some change when there has not been.
Efforts to bring about real change have stalled in the Congress, mostly due to opposition from Republicans, who do not want suing police to be easy and their qualified immunity violated. This is why, since Floyd's death, more than 1,000 people have died following police encounters. Can the Congress solve this?
Look, the fundamentals of this bill has to be greater transparency in American policing, greater accountability in American policing, and then when bad things happen, officers have to be held accountable. I don't want to negotiate parts of this out. This is actually a vast bill dealing with everything from what data small departments have to collect in around America all the way to dealing with big issues like mental health, both of officers as well as the challenges officers have when they encounter people with mental health. So I've been encouraged that we have been working not only long days, but through weekends to advance this bill.
Law enforcement in the United States has no choice but to pave the way for greater accountability and transparency in policing. Floyd's death unified people from all genders, races, and religions on the issue of social justice and police reform. People took part in marches to commemorate him and make sure their voice is heard.
The words Black Lives Matter are, it's not just about that particular organization, it's about a larger movement, it's a rallying cry. I think in that sense, Black Lives Matter has been strengthened. And I think people understand the importance of taking action, taking direct action when these killings and these acts of brutality take place. So I think it has emboldened people and strengthened this movement.
Gun violence and police brutality are frequently reported in the United States. Most of such cases usually end in favor of police, with the families of color having to pay for the consequences. Floyd's trial was broadcast live in its entirety over COVID-19 restrictions.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:44 p.m. Signed, juror foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count two. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count two, third degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:45 p.m. Signed by jury foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count three. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count three, second degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty.
That gave the public a rare look into the high-profile legal battle in real time. This has led to a rising wave of questions about the functionality of the legal system in terms of seeking justice. Many research studies and investigations attest to the idea that racism is deep-rooted within the U.S. government.
Well, certainly I think that we need to redouble our efforts in the international community. And I would make a special appeal here to our friends and comrades in Iran to be vocal about what's happening to Black people in the United States of America. You may recall that I mentioned the former Secretary of State, Michael Pompeo, who successfully blocked an investigation into police terror in the United States. You may also know that Secretary of State Michael Pompeo was a sworn enemy of Iran, and so it would be in the interest of our friends and comrades in Iran to speak out on our behalf, because when you're speaking out on our behalf, you're speaking out on your behalf.
Many thanks for your insight.
The African-American community needs to assert its international human rights to self-determination. After all, racism is deeply embedded in U.S. social institutions, which means the journey to equality is far from over. Systemic racism seems to have rippled through social institutions and into daily social interactions, making life different for Black communities compared to the white.
Our nation is moving toward two societies, one Black, one white, separate and unequal.
For generations, the United States government had communicated through laws and policies and practices, as well as narratives, that Black people were inferior. And then, virtually on a dime, the U.S. government began to say that they were wrong.
On this episode of We the People, I'm happy to be joined by Max Rameau. He's an organizer with Pan-African Community Action and a Haitian-born political theorist and author of the upcoming book on community control over the police. Max, thanks so much for joining us. Let's jump right into it. Over a year has passed since then-police officer Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd, prompting prompting a historic uprising against racist police violence. Can you tell us what's changed in the time since? And I think just as importantly, what hasn't?
So I think the things that have changed is that the fuse for people, particularly working class black people, particularly for people who are overtly repressed by the police, who are victims of police domination and control, their fuse has gotten a lot shorter. So now it doesn't take as long for people to get upset and to lash out at at injustices or perceived injustices. It used to be that urban rebellions happen only after a not guilty verdict came through as a result of a police killing and then some sort of trial. And now, if you think back to, like, for example, the Rodney King rebellion in Los Angeles in 1992. But now people know better than to wait for all that. First of all, I agree with your assessment completely. I think there are now a much larger set of people, including elected or public officials, who are willing to say things like systemic racism exists and that police brutality is real and that it exists, and maybe we should believe black people when they say that they're being harassed by the police. I think it's important that we get remain clear at all times about the cause and effect. The reason why that is true is because working class black people rose up and engage in urban rebellion. The reason that is true is because, not because there's been these police killings and not because black people are unhappy with the police killings. The reason why more prominent people, particularly government officials, are willing to say those kind of things publicly is because this time around, and the last couple times around, certainly since Mike Brown, there's been a few, Mike Brown in Ferguson and then Freddie Gray in Baltimore, and now most spectacularly George Floyd in Minneapolis, is this time around there is a consequence to police murder. So before there's a police murder and the state, all they have to do is hear us whining and complaining, or they have to wait a few more minutes in traffic as we're holding up signs. But as a result of urban rebellions and stepped up actions, there is now a consequence to state violence. And I think that consequence is what's making a difference, is what's opening up some of this ground for this. I think there's a lot of value in the acknowledgement, the public acknowledgement, that there is systemic racism and there's a problem of police brutality. And the value is that we can now say, okay, if you admit that this is true, then these are the things that you have to do in response to that. So I think that starts moving in that direction. But I just want to make crystal clear that we understand that the correlation there is not between these officials saying that and us saying, therefore, this is what you should do. The real correlation is between black communities rising up in rebellion and the officials then responding that, okay, there actually is urban rebellion. There is actually is systemic racism. We accept it.
Yeah, definitely not too difficult to see a connection between, say, the burning of the third precinct in Minneapolis by protesters just over a year ago and these changes we are discussing. Well, we want to thank our guest, Max Rameau, so much for joining us. We want to thank viewers at home for tuning in. Till next time, take care.
Less likely to say, get a job or a home loan. Social institutions, policies, rules, regulations, and laws need to change in order to offer people a fair share. Thank you for watching the show. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Join us again next week when we investigate another issue in the U.S. on We the People. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new analysis by Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, concludes that Israeli regime's attack displays a pattern of international law violations. Al-Haq argues that the violations amount to war crimes, says Esra Saleh Al-Nami, journalist, in an article titled "When Israeli regime killed doctors." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Dr. Ayman Abu Al-Auf had finished a busy shift. He wrapped it up by checking on patients with COVID-19 in the intensive care unit of Al-Shafa Hospital. As head of internal medicine at the hospital, he was acutely aware that the pandemic had not been paused. Rather, the number of coronavirus infections remained high, even though Gaza was in the news internationally due to another emergency, a large-scale Israeli regime attack. Not long after he got home from work, the building where Abu Al-Auf lived was bombed without warning. He, his wife Reem, and two of their children, Tawfiq and Tala, were killed. So were both his parents and many members of his extended family. Dr. Hawa Nasser was a colleague of Ayman Abu Al-Auf. She had accompanied him as he checked on patients that evening. "He left the hospital to get some rest after a long day," said Nasser. "It was a big shock to hear that he was then brought back to the hospital a few hours later as a dead body. It has taken us a long time to absorb that terrible news." Abu Al-Auf was popular. He had taught numerous medical students over the years. He was fond of organizing seminars to discuss advances in medicine. Patients appreciated his dedication and diligence. "When I told him that I would buy the expensive medicine I needed, he would not hear of it," said one woman who had cancer and then a stroke. "He did everything possible to ensure I could get the medicine free of charge," the woman said, on the condition of anonymity, adding, "He was a kind man." Abu Al-Auf was among two doctors killed during the early hours of May 16th, when the Israeli regime committed a massacre in the area surrounding Gaza City's Al-Wehda Street. The other was Dr. Moin Al-Alul, a neurologist. Moin's 25-year-old daughter, Aya, recalled that She had been terrified in moments leading up to the massacre, as Gaza had been under intense bombardment. She had gone into her parents' bedroom to seek a little solace. "Suddenly I found myself covered with rubble," she said. "The first thing I did was to shout out my parents' names. My mom heard me and said, 'I am here.' I asked her about my dad. She didn't tell me that he was dead. She didn't want me to lose consciousness," Aya added. "People came and dug me and my mom out of the rubble. Soon as I arrived at the hospital, I knew that my dad had been killed." Mu'in al-Alul had run several clinics across Gaza. "My father went to great lengths so that he could help people," said Aya. "On many occasions, he asked patients to pray for him rather than pay him. He was a doctor who people trusted a lot." More than 40 people were killed in the Al-Wehda Street massacre. The Israeli regime's bombardment left a large crater in a road leading to Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest medical facility. Ambulances were impeded from traveling to and from the hospital as a consequence. It was one of many incidents that had a direct impact on health services in Gaza during last month's attack. Among the facilities destroyed or damaged were Gaza's only testing center for COVID-19, two Palestinian Red Crescent ambulance stations, and a clinic caring for mothers and infants. A new analysis by Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, concludes that the Israeli regime's attack displays a pattern of international law violations. Al-Haq argues that the violations amount to war crimes. The Rome Statute, under which the International Criminal Court was established, forbids attacks against a civilian population and the destruction of civilian infrastructure. Many of Gaza's doctors have paid tribute to the two doctors killed during the massacre on Al-Wahda Street. In one tribute, their colleagues walked from Al-Shifa Hospital to the site of the buildings which the Israeli regime bombed. A section of Al-Shifa has been named in Ayman Abu Al-Af memory. "We have just done our little bit to remember the two doctors," said Dr. Muhammad Abu Selmia, Al-Shifa's director. "We believe that the best thing we can do for them is to follow the examples they set. That means taking good care of patients."
Ministry.
The Palestinian resistance is threatening to retaliate against Israeli provocations after a Qatari grant intended for families in need in the Gaza Strip was halted by the Zionist occupation. Hamas leaders have reportedly warned Egyptian mediators that they would take an important decision regarding the mutual ceasefire in the event Israel continues such unnecessary aggravations by the end of this week. The Palestinian warning came in the wake of the Qataris informing the United Nations and officials in the Biden administration that such a step provokes the Palestinians and pushes towards an explosive situation. The Palestinian message precedes the Egyptians sending invitations to 19 resistance factions to attend high-level meetings in Cairo in the presence of President Mahmoud Abbas to open dialogue between the Palestinian Authority and the resistance factions in Gaza. For the first time, Cairo invites many resistance factions other than Hamas and the Islamic Jihad to attend the dialogues at the request of Hamas, given that all the factions were equal partners in the last battle, despite objections from certain members of the Fatah movement. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance factions stressed in a joint statement the need to stop all provocations practiced by the occupation in occupied Al-Quds and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to stop the aggression against the Palestinian people, to speed up reconstruction, and to lift the siege on Gaza. In the meantime, commander of the southern region in the Israeli occupation forces, Eliezer Toledano, announced that the army was preparing to resume fighting with Hamas again, because apparently what Israel did in the last round of terrorism against Gaza was not enough, adding that the next operation will not end without changing the security reality in Gaza. Adding salt to the injury, right-wing Zionist Jewish groups announced last week that they would redo the flag march they usually did on what they call Jerusalem Day next Thursday, after their provocative march this year was canceled due to heightened tensions. The march is expected to begin at 7 p.m. Al-Quds time on Thursday, June 10, and head through multiple routes towards the Western Wall near the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli occupation forces have reportedly approved the march. However, Palestinian natives have warned that this provocation will only lead to renewed clashes. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As Palestinian factions prepare for dialogue in Cairo, the invasive scene in Gaza is becoming more complex, foretelling the possibility of another confrontation again in light of Israel's insistence on pushing the Gaza Strip. While all border crossings have been closed since the last aggression, Israel's obstruction of the Qatari fund into Gaza poured fuel on the fire, calling for a strongly worded message from the resistance, in which it affirmed that unless the funds are released by this week, it will be concerned with taking an important decision regarding the cessation of hostilities. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Julia. Now, the resistance factions have informed the Egyptian and the international mediators that the continuous Israeli provocations toward Gaza and its besieged citizens who are to benefit from the Qatari fund or the grant, which Israel is blocking, which more than 100,000 Palestinian families will be benefiting from, it will directly mean a push towards an escalation of the situation in Gaza. Do you think that Gaza can handle another round of the Israeli terrorism and violence?
Better question is, can the Zionist entity handle another round of Gazan resistance? And the answer is, it knows that it can't. The ceasefire that was called for was a one-sided ceasefire, with the Zionist entity basically begging for it, especially after basically receiving news that not only was the Zionist entity brought to its knees when the Gazan resistance barely even exhausted their old stockpiles, but the whole resistance axis was prepared to also come in on the condition that Gaza would, of course, invite them. But Israel was just definitely not ready to face like another round of rockets, including 300 rockets total fired at once, 150 alone at Tel Aviv. So it was terrified then. It's still terrified now. It's trying to even put pressure to make sure that the resistance doesn't respond to its provocations, and its provocations that we've seen in the last few weeks, including the attacks on Al-Aqsa, the harassment of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. It's trying to kind of push the envelope as far as to make itself look scary, but immediately stops once it realizes that the repercussions in another round of fighting could lead to its demise, most certainly. They released Muhammad and Muna al-Kurd within hours of detaining them. And this is out of fear. 2 days ago, the Zionist entity canceled the military parade. And today, they were too afraid to even wave their occupier flags in Jerusalem. So I would say that it is actually Israel that is put on the defensive this time.
Well, Julia, the resistance did vow that if the provocations do not stop by the end of this week, it will take an important decision by stopping or maybe just throwing away any kind of cessation of a fire or ceasefire. Mind you now, last week Isaac Herzog was elected as the new president of the Zionist entity, and it seems that a new government is on the verge of being formed in the Israeli entity. But is it wise for Netanyahu at this moment to get involved in another round of aggression, which he sees the best, maybe the best boat out of this chaos inside of the Israeli regime?
Yeah, so Netanyahu's regime, Netanyahu and his party specifically, the far-right coalition he attempted to assemble up and push the deal of the century, which failed, the provocations against Lebanon, the attacks on resistance factions in Syria and on the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq 2 years ago, those have backfired. So Netanyahu right now in an attempt to shore up legitimacy, especially in the face of a multi-factional coalition of the Zionist entity that's attempting to kind of save face of the entity itself in face of, in light of Netanyahu's repeated failures. He's just trying to kind of salvage the little legitimacy that he is attempting to have. You know, he has corruption charges, the collapse of his government and his coalition. So what this is essentially is that, like I said, he knows that he can't really stand a chance militarily or even politically at this point. But it's a sad attempt to save face, essentially.
Well, during all these developments, we did see an invitation by Cairo for 19 Palestinian factions from the Gaza Strip that took part in the last battle against Gaza. This meeting is supposed to happen in Cairo in the presence of the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. And as I told you, most of the factions are invited for the first time in such high-level talks. But some Fatah movement members were vocal about their rejection of such an invitation, meaning a wide-scope invitation allowing all the Palestinian factions in. Is there a chance that these talks might actually be fruitful, given that Abbas still refuses to acknowledge the very last election that happened when Hamas won the elections?
The whole context of the talks reflects the context of the Palestinian resistance and the force on the ground, essentially. So the Palestinian resistance is more united than ever. They have been more united in the face of struggle and in the face of the siege that has last occurred. And it is also clearer than ever that the PA, which is essentially the neocolonial force, containing Gaza, containing the West Bank at the direction of the occupation, which has collaborated against the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people to the benefit of the Zionist occupation, their legitimacy has completely collapsed. And they, just as Israel is more insecure than ever, so is the Palestinian Authority. As a neo-colonial police force that is essentially losing its legitimacy and authority. So see, in the face of a Palestinian resistance that is essentially more unified than ever, it's just clear that these recent remarks and this bitterness by Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority reaffirms its lack of stance at all with the Palestinian resistance and with the Palestinian people. And this is something that's consistent.
Well, in the meantime, we had the commander of the southern region of the Israeli occupation forces, his name is Eleazar Toledano, announced that Israel is preparing to resume the fighting against Gaza, and they have in mind that this time they will not allow the security of the resistance to remain intact inside of the Gaza Strip. So we're talking about massacres here, a continuation of the incremental genocide by the Israeli entity against the people of Gaza. Sayyid Nasrallah was very clear. The Secretary General of Hezbollah said in his last appearance that there will be a regional war if the Zionist entity provokes the Palestinian people, whether it is in Gaza or in Al-Quds. But he was very clear, Al-Quds equals a regional war. Do you think that we are on a verge of the biggest war that this region has ever seen?
You know, I think that I'm positive that the Zionist entity's talks right now, you know, it wanting to be provocative, it's just empty talk, essentially, because it understands, and the resistance has made it clear, Yahya Sinwar of Hamas and Sayyid Nasrallah have made it very, very clear, along with other, you know, leaders of the resistance axis, that there is full support and coordination from all members of the resistance axis to the resistance factions in Gaza, and this will be furthered into a complete campaign to liberate Palestine and Al-Aqsa should Israel fall completely through on its provocations and wage another attack of the same nature. We're to see that becoming more clear by the end of this week. But it is definitely clear that the Zionist entity, though they do not want to have any kind of provocations that's going to make them instantly lose, they still kind of want to save face. I mean, the entity begged for a ceasefire just because people, settlers, were tired of running to bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, it's just a balance that the Zionist entity is trying to have of saving face and trying to make itself look like it has any legitimacy left, which it doesn't, can ensure any protection of its illegal settlers, which it can't. And the resistance, which is on the verge of victory right now, we can envision victory as Lebanese, as Palestinians, and there is full preparation to attain it, if the Zionist entity makes any stupid moves.
Well, it's going to be a very decisive week indeed. Thank you very much, Julia Qasim from Beirut, political commentator, talking to us about the prospects of another ignition of fire between the Palestinians and the Israeli Zionist entity. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen being part of the equation of Al-Quds.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, leader of the Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced that the Yemeni people are part of the deterrence equation established by regional resistance in linking the Israeli threat towards Al-Quds to a regional war. Sayyid Houthi criticized the Saudi and the Emirati media and their shameful handling of the recent Israeli aggression on Gaza while praising the Iranian position. Sayyid Houthi also identified three steps to attain peace in Yemen: stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the siege, and ending the occupation. More in this following report.
Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi, stressed last week that the Yemenis are part of the Al-Quds formula, as announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, and will be present effectively in the battle against the Zionist entity. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah consecrated during his speech on the 21st anniversary of Resistance and Liberation Day a new formula: if Israel tampers with Al-Quds, it will face a regional war. Sayyid Houthi indicated that Hezbollah and the Palestinian resistance were not supported by any Arab or Muslim state except Iran and Syria, highlighting the importance of the recent victory in Gaza. Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement then urged Muslim countries to join forces against Israel in order to expel its regime from the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds and to completely boycott the Tel Aviv regime. The Yemeni leader noted that the pro-Israeli traitors accused the resistance forces of being Iran's proxy groups, adding that the Takfiri war launched against them only serves the U.S. and Israel. Meanwhile, Sayyid Houthi stressed that the peaceful solution in Yemen can be reached when the Saudi-led coalition halts its war and blockade on the Yemenis, adding that the Yemeni nation will not give up its right to freedom, independence, and dignity, and will not abandon its struggle against American and Israeli plots. Furthermore, in an indication of positive developments in the ongoing negotiations to stop the Saudi war in Yemen, an Omani delegation arrived in the Yemeni capital Sana'a on a visit, the first of its kind in years, on Saturday. The delegation was accompanied to Sana'a Airport by the spokesman of the Ansarullah Resistance Movement and the head of the Sana'a negotiating delegation, Muhammad Abdussalam, on a plane belonging to the Omani Royal Air Force. Upon his arrival at Sana'a Airport, Abdussalam said that the delegation of the Royal Office came to discuss the situation in Yemen on the basis of the principle of common interests. Abdussalam noted that the aim of the Omani delegation's visit was to work on advancing the humanitarian situation as well as the peace process.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Sana'a is Mr. Muhammad Ashami, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Muhammad. Now, Sayyid Abdulmalik Al-Houthi made it clear that Yemen will be part of the deterrence equation established by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in linking the Israeli threat towards Al-Quds to a regional war. Are we going to see Yemeni ballistic missiles landing in the occupied territories of Palestine against the Zionist entity?
Israeli occupation forces take those warnings lightly from both Sayyid Nasrullah and Sayyid Al-Houthi, and I believe we may see defense operations and ballistic missiles, drone attacks as well, following the Zionist forces from Yemen. The remarks by both leaders reflect a higher, improved level of coordination amongst the resistance access, and affirms that Yemen today is a strong, integral part of the of this new equation.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, Sayyid Abdulmalik went on to say that the Saudi and the Emirati media outlets took up a hostile position towards the Palestinian people, and especially the Palestinian resistance factions inside of Gaza who were were bombing retaliatory rocket attacks against the Israeli entity, proving their allegiance to the Zionist regime. Sadly, I'm talking about the media in the Persian Arab Gulf states. This strategy was surely part of the normalization process which these states have started with the Zionist entity last year. Do you think this strategy was enough maybe to subdue their citizens into accepting ties with this warmongering entity that committed massacres against the Palestinian people?
We all noticed that both Saudi and the Emirati exerted a very high level of media effort trying to spread their propaganda against Iran and the Palestinian resistance, while covering up also at the same time for the war crimes committed by the Israeli occupation. This in itself can be taken as an indication that there are many people inside Saudi and the UAE who do not probably buy into this narration, Zionist Arab version of the narration, especially following the resistance's latest victory in Gaza, and the increasing awareness that Iran has been actually at the heart of Palestine, supporting and assisting its resistance. So no, I don't think that people are buying that narration.
Well, something very important happened on Saturday is the landing of Omani plane, on board of which is Omani committee alongside the spokesperson of the Ansarullah movement, which breaks way for serious negotiations and dialogue to end the Saudi war on Yemen. What are your views on this?
The Omani delegation that has just arrived with the head of the national delegation, Muhammad Abdussalam, they arrived a couple of days back, and they said that they are continuing the discussions they had started in Muscat. Muhammad Abdussalam did not comment much about it, but he implied in his brief comments that they will be discussing first the humanitarian issues, and hopefully if the coalition is serious about it this time, then this may lead to opening other discussions leading to complete ceasefire and bringing back peace to Yemen. We hope that they are serious about it this time.
Sayyid Abdulmalik Al-Houthi did identify three very important steps for peace in Yemen, which includes stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the blockade and the siege of the Yemeni population, and ending the occupation. He means the Saudi and the Emirati occupation of Yemeni land. Mohammed bin Salman has turned several opportunities down that would have made this halting of an aggression at least somewhat easier than bringing it to this level right now. What is Mohammed bin Salman really counting on that would secure him a political gain, which for the past 6 years he had never been able to attain on the field, in the battlefield of Yemen?
Well, let's agree on one thing first. Saudi has lost its military war in Yemen. On the other hand, Yemen counterattacks are becoming more severe, more frequent, and more painful. So what are the options for Saudi? Causing maximum humanitarian damage to 30 million people, and that's what they are trying to do. They use that to negotiate military terms. For example, they say, okay, we will release you some of the fuel vessels, provided you stop advancing towards Marib, which is ridiculous.